The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Means of Ascent by Robert A. Carroll. Continued. Cassette 9, Side 1. He couldn't control himself even with or in front of the press. He cultivated the reporters covering the campaign, at times with exaggerated flattery, at times with touches of unique political genius. One device he employed, and perhaps invented, was to introduce the members of the press to the audience at small towns. This impressed audiences and gave the townspeople a sense of identity with his campaign. In the case of an Alan Duckworth of the Dallas News or Jack Wynn of the Houston Post, whose names were familiar, when you're in a town of 800 or 900 people, why, they like to see the face of the byline they read, Charles Boatner of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram explains, while at the same time making the reporters feel like celebrities. But the flattery alternated with harsh tongue-lashings over the slightest hint of criticism in their stories. He even ridiculed them for no reason at all, displaying as he did so that keen insight into other men's feelings that enabled him to wound them so deeply. Dave Chevens of the Associated Press was, recalls fellow reporter Margaret Mayer, a fat, chubby little fellow, a sweet man, a great fellow, but really fat and sensitive about it. At one point, Chevens was scheduled to board the helicopter after Johnson's speech and ride to the next town with him. The helicopter was parked on the far side of the broad plowed field from the speaker's platform. After the speech, Johnson was hurrying across the field, his long legs enabling him to stride over the furrows. Chevens, scrambling awkwardly after him, was falling farther and farther behind. Johnson shouted over his shoulder, "Come on, Chevens! Won't those little fat legs of yours carry you any faster than that?" It was the type of thing that Johnson seemed to think he was entitled to say, Mayer says. He could be quite mean to the reporters. He thought he could get away with things like that. And indeed he could, because in Mayer's words, Johnson had courted favor with publishers all over the state. Reporters whose coverage of the campaign displeased him were transferred off the campaign or fired. During one of his trips to North Texas, Johnson had spotted an article in the little Palo Pinto Star, which did not meet his standards for reportorial accuracy. He ordered a former NYA assistant, Tony Ziegler, to get in touch with a local supporter, Judge Pat Corrigan of Mineral Wells, and see if it could be stopped. Corrigan shortly informed Ziegler that Mr. Brown, who is with the Palo Pinto Star, is no longer with them. Jack Wynn's articles on the Houston Post were impartial, but impartiality was not what Johnson had in mind from the newspaper whose publisher, former Governor William P. Hobby, had so admired Sam Ely Johnson. Frank Altorf was Johnson's campaign manager for one of the North Central Texas districts, but Johnson knew that Hobby was fond of Altorf, a distant cousin. Telephoning Altorf one evening, Johnson told him to ask the governor if he could cover the Johnson campaign. Altorf did so, and the governor agreed, although Altorf's only previous newspaper experience had been as the paper's student stringer at Rice University. Asked how he would characterize his campaign stories for one of the state's largest newspapers, Altorf says with a small smile, "They were adequate, and they certainly weren't unfriendly." "Did the editors rewrite you much?" Smile. "No." Some reporters got their first view of Lyndon Johnson's relationship with subordinates during this campaign, and it upset them so deeply that occasionally one would attempt to intervene. One evening, the candidate had some of the top state political reporters in his suite, talking to them, stroking them, but he wanted something from Mary Rather, and he spoke roughly and crudely to her, using obscenities that shocked even these hard-bitten reporters. After a minute or two, Felix McKnight of the Dallas News burst out, "You can't talk to her like that. Apologize to her." But Johnson was totally oblivious to what he had done, and it appeared Mary was too. She was used to it. The moment passed away without an apology, but almost none of this feeling showed up in so much as a hint in the reporter's articles. He could not control himself even when on stage before the voters he was wooing. As his confidence grew, he seemed to feel that he had them in his grasp as he had his subordinates, and he began to treat them the same way. Circling a town in the S-51, as Phipps urged over the loudspeaker, "Come to the speaking, come to the speaking," he would grow irritated if the response was below expectations. Snatching the loudspeaker from Phipps, he would do the urging himself, and even through the loudspeaker's distortion, what Busby calls the umbrage in the voice was clear as it bellowed, "Come on out to the speaking!" During his speeches, anything less than total attention from his audience evoked the same reaction. Most politicians display affection for the children of potential voters. Johnson, however, was not particularly fond of children in any circumstances, according to Busby, and although their presence was necessary to attract their parents to his helicopter landings, he didn't intend to tolerate any nonsense from them. If there were childish antics in the crowd, the candidate would stop talking. And Busby says, "I learned one thing. If he stopped, hide. You weren't going to like what happened next." Busby took his own advice, literally. Once, when Johnson stopped and stared down into the crowd at a little boy who was talking or something, Busby says, "I went behind a tree." He kept staring at the boy and finally said, "I'm not going to go on until the mother of this squirt comes up here and dusts his britches." Receiving reports of Johnson's behavior, Alvin Wirtz attempted to calm him down, and his telephone calls worked for the first hour or two each day, but by mid-morning his quiet counsel had faded before the visions of victory dancing in Johnson's head. He had added to his speeches now a chant in which he asked audiences to join, and if the participation of the public wasn't always enthusiastic, there was usually enough of a clack on hand to make things sound as if it was. "Ain't gonna be no runoff," Johnson would say. "I'm going to win without a runoff. Now let's hear it." And the crowd, led by the clack, would chant, "Ain't going to be no runoff." Whatever the young men in the Hancock House may have believed, the older, more experienced men in the Brown building knew there was no realistic possibility of that prediction coming true. Johnson might do far better than had been expected, they felt, but as for polling more than half the vote, the chant, they felt, was a campaign device. No one could seriously believe it might happen. But Ed Clark, talking one night in late June to the candidate, a candidate utterly in the grip of euphoria, came to a shocking realization. Lyndon Johnson believed it. And then, on the 4th of July weekend, came the Texas Cowboy Reunion. The reunion had been begun in 1930 by Texans concerned by the thinning ranks of true cowboys, the embodiment not just of a way of life, but of the spirit and principles that made Texas so special. Its sponsors had picked a perfect site, a little town, Stamford, that sat on the vast rolling plains of West Texas like the set of a Western movie, right down to the headquarters of a working ranch, the Swenson Ranch, which was located on the town square, with its facade bearing the ranch's famous SMS brand, with two backwards S's. Stamford was located in the very heart of what had been the land of the Mustangers, the men who captured wild horses and drove them to northern markets. Children in this area grew up to the stories of the Mustang Stallions, Black Devil, Starface, the Pacing Wild Stallion, and, best remembered of all, Midnight, the great black herd leader who for years had outwitted men to keep his mares and foals free. By 1948, the Mustangs had gone the way of the buffalo, but the great herds of cattle stretching to the horizon were still there, and so were the cowboys who herded them, sitting lonely guard against the horizon, and so was the cowboys' way of life. As one writer put it, "Throughout this part of Texas, the atmosphere of the West prevails so strongly that automobiles almost look out of place." The reunion's founders had designed it to preserve and revitalize the cowboys' traditions and skills by holding bunkhouse dances, chuck wagon meals, and a rodeo in which participation was limited to non-professionals to ensure that only true cowboys, men who were still actually working the range, would compete. Ranches sent their top hands to the 3 days of roping, cutting out, and riding contests that were held over each 4th of July weekend. During the war, the young men of the ranches, the sons of the ranch owners and their cowboys, had gone off to fight, and the reunion's founders had feared the event would die away. But after the war, it actually became bigger than ever. Families would come from all over the Panhandle and West Texas, some in pickup trucks, but an astonishingly large percentage in chuck wagons, which would stand in a huge encampment on an area set aside outside of town near the 50 acres of horse and cattle corrals around the Rodeo Grandstand. In 1948, the attendance was more than 25,000. Coke Stevenson arrived on a morning during which, as Bob Murphy drove him across the plains, he had listened to Lyndon Johnson assailing him. In his radio broadcast that morning, Johnson had said, "Old men killed Woodrow Wilson's plan for the League of Nations. Old men in the Senate. I could say pipe-puffing old men, but that might look like a reference to one of my opponents." He himself had fought in the last war, Johnson said, unlike his opponent. "I didn't sit and puff my pipe when our country was at war." Arriving at Stamford, Stevenson was told that a big crowd of reporters was on hand, not to see him, but to see Johnson's helicopter, which was scheduled to land at the rodeo site later that day. A Johnson sound truck was driving through the town, taunting him. "Coke, if you've never seen a helicopter, here's your chance." The reporters crowded around him, asking him to hold a press conference. "I'm not here for politics," he replied. "I'm here to be with my friends." Since he would be riding in the parade, he had brought along his black boots, and he bent down and tugged them on. Two riders carrying huge flags, one the Stars and Stripes, the other the Lone Star, were first in the parade, and behind them came six pretty girls in cowboy regalia on six white horses, leading the famous cowboy band of Abilene's Hardin-Simmons University, also in cowboy regalia, playing Sousa marches. And then came the riders, hundreds of them, who had been milling around in giant corrals waiting for the parade to start, in a long column of threes. There were so many of them that even over the music you could hear the thudding of hooves. Coke Stevenson led them out. He felt that it was not right for a candidate for office to be leading the parade, and his old friend Bill Swenson of the SMS, president of the reunion, had said he would ride beside him. But as the parade began, Swenson reined in his horse so that he was a few steps behind, and Stevenson was alone. He was riding Pal, a big, magnificently muscled Palomino, but Stevenson, with his great shoulders and the erectness with which he held himself in the saddle, seemed almost too big for him. He was still wearing a brown business suit and his gray Stetson hat without the wide brim, but the crowd watching him come saw a man riding like the cowboys behind him, sitting easily, deep and back in the saddle, with a lot of leather showing in front, where it was most comfortable for the horse. Made nervous by the music and the excitement, Pal shied and pranced at first, but Stevenson calmed him down. There were no cheers, but as he rode, people called out to him. "Hello, Coke. Hey, Coke. Howdy, Coke." He called back. "Hello, Jack. Hello, Bill." A reporter realized that what he was seeing was an exchange of greetings from old friends. At first the calls were scattered, but as he rode along there were more and more of them until they were almost a continuous chorus. Along the whole line of march, what you heard between the noise of the band fading ahead and the noise of the hooves mounting behind was, as one reporter wrote, "one constant greeting from the sidewalk crowds, a quiet but immense outpouring of affection." And there was a gesture, too. It was a cowboy gesture, a peculiarly Texas gesture. In fact, for cowboys do not tip their hats except to ladies. As men said, "Hello, Coke," they would touch one or two fingers to the brim of their Stetsons and then point the fingers toward the big man riding by. Even men who didn't call out made that gesture. Every man in the crowd was making it seemed. To Murphy, standing on the porch of the hotel, watching his uncle ride toward him, it looked as if hands were rising and touching hat brims in a long wave as Coke Stevenson passed by, almost in a kind of salute. And it wasn't only old men making that sign of respect. The young men in the crowd, the sons and grandsons of the old ranchmen who had settled this range, were making it too. Their fathers and grandfathers had told them the story of Coke Stevenson, about the young boy starting up the freight line and studying at night in the lonely hills, about the young rider herding cattle up on the divide, about the founding of the famous ranch, about the love story of Coke and Fay, the young wife who had believed her husband should be governor, about the rancher who was speaker and lieutenant governor and governor, had never become a politician, had never betrayed his standards, which were, of course, their standards, too, about their beloved cowboy governor, their own governor. And as he came closer, the big man sitting so erect and calm on the prancing horse, the young men, too, touched the brims of their hats in salute. Behind the crowd, wherever there was space, were pickup trucks parked in a long row. Their owners, mostly young couples, would be standing in the backs of the trucks with their children so that they could see over the heads of the crowd. But often the children couldn't see. So as Coke Stevenson approached, fathers and mothers would pick up their children and put them on their shoulders or hold them up in the air, so that they, too, could see Mr. Texas passing by. After the parade, the 5,000-seat grandstand was filled to overflowing for the rodeo. Stevenson was sitting in the judge's box. Five other state officials and candidates for office were with him, and before the rodeo began, the master of ceremonies introduced them one by one. The first five introductions were greeted by a polite but unenthusiastic sprinkling of applause. Then the announcer began, "Our beloved former governor," and suddenly, before the announcer could finish, everyone was cheering. They were giving the rebel yell. They were throwing their hats in the air. Four or five riders who had been waiting on horseback against one wall to help in the events caught up in the excitement spurred their horses into a gallop across the arena, came to a rearing halt before the judge's box, and waved their hats toward Stevenson. Everyone was shouting, "Coke! Coke! Coke!" Bob Murphy remembers how moved his uncle was by what had happened. Driving away from Stamford that night, Stevenson said, "Bob, the kind of people you saw today, remember them. The ranching business is changing. That kind of people, you won't see them again." And Bob Murphy remembers what he thought when his uncle said that. "I didn't say anything," he recalls, "but I thought, Uncle Coke, we won't ever see your kind again either." The reporters who were waiting for Lyndon Johnson's helicopter at the cowboy reunion were disappointed. At his final stop before Stamford, the town of Aspermont, 27 miles away, he had received a telephone call describing the reception Coke Stevenson was being given at the reunion. He decided not to attend. Using the excuse that his helicopter was low on fuel because a truckload of gasoline had missed connections, he flew instead to Abilene. Bad news was waiting for him there, too. The result of the latest private poll he had commissioned, and advance news of the latest Belden poll, which was even then in progress and would be completed the next day. In the previous Belden poll, Johnson had pulled closer to Stevenson. Stevenson had led Johnson by only 47% to 37% among voters whose preference had been decided. 23% of all voters had not decided. In Belden's new poll, the percentage of undecideds had dropped from 23% to 18%, but Johnson's gains had all but come to a halt. Among voters with a preference, Stevenson still led them, 47% to 38%. Petty had 10%, the 8 minor candidates a total of 4%. The results, which Belden summarized as almost the same as the results of the poll a month before, were disquieting. During the month just past, the month of the great excitement over his helicopter, Johnson had picked up exactly 1 percentage point, and Coke had lost not even one. The percentages in Johnson's private poll cannot be found, but men connected with his campaign recall that its findings were even more unfavorable than Belden's. For a candidate as sophisticated as Johnson in interpreting polling figures, the news was discouraging. Since all the excitement about his campaign during the past month, the massive money poured into it, had not cut further into Coke Stevenson's strength, cutting further might well be impossible. During that month, Johnson's name had been brought before the voters in Texas not only by newspaper and radio coverage, but in an unprecedentedly heavy wave of newspaper and radio advertising, direct mail, billboards, handbills. And Johnson, in his campaigning in so many small towns, had been brought before the voters in person. The result? No significant increase in his support. Had he reached the limit of his support, a limit above which he could not go? He had drawn hope in the early June poll from the high percentage of undecided voters. Now a substantial number of those voters were no longer undecided, but, contrary to his firm expectation, they had not decided for him, at least not by any substantial majority. Almost as many were going into Coke's camp as into his. Most ominous of all, of course, was the fact that with 18% of the voters still undecided, Coke with 47% was very close to 50.1%, the majority which would make the first primary also the last. Lyndon Johnson's prediction, "ain't gonna be no runoff," might prove accurate, but not in the way he had intended. With only 3 weeks to go before the first primary, there was a strong possibility that despite Petty's presence in the race, the first primary would be the last. Lyndon Johnson might well have to overtake Coke Stevenson in only 3 weeks. And study the poll results, though he might that night in his hotel room in Abilene, they contained no indication that he could do it. They told him that he was on the verge of losing his last chance. After that night in Abilene, the euphoria was gone. It was replaced by desperation. By coincidence, the next day, he got a new helicopter. The S-51, having reached the limit of mileage it could fly without a major checkup and overhaul, left on its return trip to Connecticut, and it was replaced by a 47D model furnished, at Stuart Symington's request, by the Bell Helicopter Corporation. Dramatic as Johnson's campaign had been before, now the drama was heightened. The 47D was much smaller than the S-51, little more than a plexiglass bubble, 5 feet wide, 5 feet long, and 5 feet high, barely big enough to seat a pilot and a passenger at the front of a 23-foot-long fuselage. It looked like a toy in comparison with the Sikorsky craft. Because it required so much less space in which to land, it could get in closer to the centers of population, where the landings were most effective. And its pilot, Joe Mashman, a 32-year-old test pilot, could use its greater maneuverability to perform new crowd-pleasing stunts before and after landings. Its engine generated a meager 178 horsepower at best, and less in hot weather, so that with a load of any size, Mashman was to recall, that little engine had to strain just to keep the aircraft airborne. Hardly had he landed in Austin when KTBC radio engineers arrived with an amplifier and a microphone, which they told him the helicopter was going to have to carry, and which weighed 100 pounds. Next, cars drove up with bundles of campaign literature for the candidate to distribute at unscheduled stops. And then the candidate himself arrived. He displayed no interest in the little craft, but just got on and said, "Let's go." No one had told Mashman how big Lyndon Johnson was, and he was dismayed to find out. One look at him, the pilot was to recall, and I knew I had a problem. Exacerbating the problem would be the necessity, caused by the candidate's insistence on landing as close to the center of town as possible, of taking off from constricted areas, which required rising steeply, often almost vertically, and thus using more power than if the helicopter could, as was normal, rise on a shallower climb. Although Mashman would keep the weight down by never filling the gas tank to capacity, for the remainder of the campaign, as the little brother of the Johnson City windmill toured small towns all across Texas, almost every takeoff was an adventure. Mashman would lift off a few feet above ground, and then inch a little higher, hovering while studying his instruments to determine if he had sufficient reserve, or unused power capacity, to safely climb on out. Often the instruments would show that he was using all the power the engine could generate just to hover, and he would have to return to the ground. The pamphlets would be unloaded and put in a car which would meet the helicopter outside town, at a location at which there would be more room and less power needed for takeoff. But sometimes that didn't help sufficiently. "Mr. Johnson, we've got to take the doors off," Mashman would say. If the 15 pounds thus saved still wasn't enough, the only remaining jettisonable item would have to go. Mashman would set the helicopter down again, and the candidate would disembark, and a car would drive him to the site outside town. After a day or two, Mashman learned to evaluate the situation in advance. As he circled the town, with Johnson using the bullhorn to round up the populace, Mashman, if he saw it was going to be tight, would tell his passenger he would be able to land with him but not take off. Johnson turned these difficulties to advantage. In the past, some of the people attracted to the landing site by the helicopter would drift away before his speech. Now Johnson devised a tactic to keep them from doing so. After the helicopter had landed, and he had told the audience to come on around and look at the whirlybird, he would, before beginning his speech, say, "My good pilot Joe tells me it'll be too dangerous if I take off with him because we wouldn't have enough power to clear these 30,000-volt high-tension wires over there. He's going to have to take off alone, and it's going to be mighty tight. I just hope and pray he'll be able to make it." Then, having, as Mashman puts it, told the people of the impending daredevil feat, he would launch into his political speech. If people started leaving anyway, Johnson would ask them not to. "Now, folks, I want you to stay here and wait until Joe tries to get the Johnson City windmill off the ground. He's going to need all the help he can get. He's going to need your prayers to get through this safely. We're all hoping that the good Lord sees that Joe gets over those high tension wires over there. I know we'll all be here helping to pray for him." And indeed, as the pilot lifted off at the end of the speech, Lyndon Johnson would, in an effective climax to his little rally, lead the crowd in prayers for his safety. "Let's pray for Joe now. Good luck, Joe. We're with you, Joe. Help him, O Lord. Help this brave man make it out of here safely." But Johnson was aware now of the limitations of helicopter drama. The polls had told him that. The helicopter could lure people out to meet him. It could even keep them around to listen to him. It couldn't persuade them to vote for him, not over Coke Stevenson. Only he could do that. Hard as he had worked before, now during the 3 remaining weeks between the 4th of July weekend and the first primary, he worked harder. The summer of 1948 was a summer, day after day, week after week, of a laconic one-word weather forecast. Hot. That summer, the summer of Lyndon Johnson's last chance, was in fact one of the hottest summers of the century in Texas. It was a summer of terrible drought, and in bone-dry East Texas, of widespread forest fires. Day after day, all across the vast state, the thermometer rose to near 100 degrees by mid-morning and stayed there until sunset. Sunset brought only minor relief. The nights were little cooler. Few small-town hotels had air conditioning. After 10 or 11 hours out in that blazing sun each day, Lyndon Johnson had to sleep at night in steaming hot rooms. During the day, moreover, the helicopter in which he was spending so many hours was no longer the big Sikorsky S-51, whose roof extended partly over the back seat, providing some shade there for Johnson. Tudors, who had to remain in the front seat to pilot the S-51, says that flying surrounded by unprotected glass on which the sun was beating down was as hot as flying in a greenhouse. In the tiny Bell, there was no shade, nothing around Johnson and his new pilot but the curved plexiglass bubble that intensified the sun's rays. Mashman, who had flown helicopters in Brazil for a year, had considered himself inured to heat, but that was only because he had never experienced the valley during a drought. Even removing the helicopter's doors didn't help. With the high humidity in the valley, or Galveston or Houston, with the temperature in the 90s, the wind from the open doors didn't help because our perspiration wouldn't evaporate. We would be just dripping in there. Most landing sites were naked of shade, of course, since they'd been selected because there were no trees or buildings on them. After landing the helicopter, Mashman could hunt up a tree or a house and take advantage of its shade. Johnson couldn't. Sometimes so brutal was the sun that Mashman, before leaving the helicopter, would slowly rotate the rotor blades until one of them was between the candidate and the sun, and Johnson would try to speak while remaining in that sliver of shade, but an 8-inch-wide rotor blade provided pathetically little protection. Campaigning in Texas during the summer of 1948 was, in the memory of those who were there, like campaigning in an oven. Behind in the race, watching his last chance fade, Lyndon Johnson was campaigning longer and longer hours now, but no matter how long the hours were, they weren't long enough for him. There was no more talk about breaks in the schedule. Johnson wanted more speeches, more hoverings over towns too small for speeches, more handshakings. A break meant minutes lost, possible votes lost. He knew now that he needed every one. Woodward had thought 8 or 9 speeches a day, plus the morning and evening radio talks, the limit of the endurance even of Lyndon Johnson. Now, in the first 2 days after the 4th of July revelation, touring in the merciless heat of Texas's Gulf Coast, Lyndon Johnson delivered, in addition to his radio broadcasts, 31 stump speeches, and made 50 unscheduled stops to shake hands with cotton pickers, farmers, or just a lone man driving a tractor. On the second day, he couldn't seem to tear himself away from Robstown, where, as a teenager who had run away from home, he had worked 11 hours a day in a roasting hot cotton gin in which the air was so thick with dust and lint from the cotton being pounded into bales that men working in it often found themselves gasping for breath. His job had been tending a big steam boiler, and he'd been constantly terrified that it would explode as other boilers had exploded in Robstown gins that year. By the time he arrived in Corpus Christi on that second day, it was just before dark. Mashman, who'd been watching shadows close in around his craft, breathed a sigh of relief when he had it on the ground before total darkness. Jumping out of the helicopter and into a waiting car, exhorting the driver to greater speed, Johnson raced into the downtown area of the city and shook hands with passing pedestrians for hours. The next day's campaigning was summarized by a headline in the Houston Post. Johnson in 24 public appearances in day. The length of time he had been out on the road that day was summarized in a phrase in the story, sun up to sundown. On the following day, Thursday, July 8th, thunderstorms hit the Gulf Coast as Johnson was flying along the coastline for a scheduled stop at Bay City. Ahead of the helicopter was swirling blackness. When Mashman said he couldn't land in the storm, Johnson ordered the pilot to circle the storm as close to it as possible so as to lose the least time on the way to the next stop at West Columbia. The speeches he was giving were different, too. He was scared now, as scared as he had been in his first campaign in 1937. Now his chance wasn't his first, but his last, and he was no longer the well-tailored senatorial candidate of the first few weeks of this campaign. He was the Lyndon Johnson of 1937 again, awkward, nervous, frightened, and one of the greatest stump speakers in Texas history. He wasn't trying to act like a senator now. He wasn't trying to act like a statesman. He was trying to win. The people in front of him held his fate in their hands. He told them he was one of them. "I'm a country boy, too," he told them. the statement which wasn't hard to believe as he stood there, tall and skinny, in his soaked-through shirt and bedraggled tie and wrinkled, baggy seersucker trousers, his face grimy and sweat-streaked. "I chopped cotton, I hoed my daddy's fields." And because he was one of them, he told them, he understood how city people, like the people in Houston and Dallas who were backing Coke Stevenson, looked down on them. "They're saying I was a goat herder," he said. "That's right, I was. They say I was just a country school teacher. That's right, I was. But there's sure nothing wrong with that. I've had calluses on my hands. I worked on the first roads that ever got built in my county, with these hands. And I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud of it." When he was young, he had gone through the trials their sons had gone through. He had shared their sons' dangers, too, he told them. In the South Pacific, this boy I roomed with, he was a country boy, too. He had shared all their hopes and fears. As a boy, he said, he had lived on a farm that did not have electricity, and he had seen his sainted mother down on her knees every wash day, scrubbing clothes in a wash tub, and standing all day over that red-hot cook stove, ironing clothes with those heavy, sad irons, in a steaming hot kitchen in midsummer, so that I and my brother and my sisters would be neat like the other kids. And as a congressman, he said, he'd help the people of his district to realize their hopes and dreams. Getting electricity for his district hadn't been easy, he told them, and he told how the Rural Electrification Administration officials had told FDR that the population wasn't dense enough, and how FDR had replied, "Oh, they breed pretty fast down there," and how the REA had then said, "Those people are too poor, they won't pay their bills." "The interests and the trusts, they were against us," Lyndon Johnson said. "The power companies and the utility barons, they said, you can't take lights out to those people. You can't sink poles in that granite." "Well, we got the holes in," he would say, "and we got the poles up. We put lights in 20,000 farm homes. And you know how many bills were delinquent? Not one. We can put REA lights in every rural home in Texas. We can build a blacktop road to every farm. We can pay our elder citizens a pension of $50 a month. We can pay our teachers an extra $400 a year. We can guarantee the farmer minimum prices on farm products. We can build hospitals in every county." When he talked about foreign affairs now, the phrases he used were phrases to which these listeners could relate. He played on their fears as he played on their hopes. America was in great danger, he told them. It was in danger from the red tide of communism, which was constantly planning a sneak attack. Houston or Galveston could easily be the next Pearl Harbor. "This is off the record," he would confide, "but I can tell you that in 1951 another nation will have the atomic bomb. 20 bombs in 20 places in 20 minutes could immobilize the United States." And he said it was not just the atomic bomb that Americans must fear. The next war, he said, would be a war not only of bombs, but of germ warfare, whose horrors he vividly portrayed. Therefore, he advised his audience they should pray. "From the time you say the blessing before breakfast in the morning until the last child is tucked in at night, pray that we will find the solution to the problem of peace." But prayer was not the only answer to the problem, he said. America must also be prepared. It must be strong. "Nobody would walk up and give Jack Dempsey a punch in the nose," he said. "And nobody's going to give us a punch in the nose if we're strong enough, too." That was the reason, he said, that he was for a 70-group Air Force. 70 groups? "I wish it were 170 groups. We need the best atomic bomb that money can buy," he said. "And we must have a policy of not yielding an inch to the communists. America must draw the quarantine line, and we would rather have it on the Mediterranean than on the shore of the Gulf of Mexico." The communists, he said, are ready to move in on Berlin if America yields 1 inch. 1 inch, he would shout, shaking a long finger in warning. 1 inch! He would say whatever they wanted to hear. To rural audiences, he shouted, "The day is over in Texas when people will work for sheepherders' wages while a few rich men skim all the cream." But to wealthy listeners, businessmen and oil men in the Petroleum Club of Dallas or the Ramada Club in Houston, his vocabulary was not populist but plutocratic, and the cream, increasing the cream, was what he emphasized. He didn't merely say the oil depletion allowance should be continued. He said it should be increased immediately from 27.5% to 30%. Moreover, the government should set up a system of allocation of scarce materials to oil producers so that they would come first on the list. In labor districts, he was pro-labor. In anti-labor districts, he was anti-labor. And in both districts, he was very effective. And when he talked about his opponent, he was just as effective. His listeners' respect for Coke Stevenson was the main obstacle between him and his dream. It had to be destroyed. And no one could destroy a reputation better than Lyndon Johnson. Mimicking his opponent had become a staple of his appearances, of course, and it invariably got a laugh. But making his listeners laugh at Coke Stevenson was no longer enough. He had to make them angry at him. And as the sight of a corncob pipe in a farmer's mouth had given him inspiration, so now did faces in a window. The window was in the second story of the county courthouse in the North Texas town of Weatherford. On July 17th, both candidates campaigned in the town. Stevenson had shaken hands and toured the courthouse in the early morning, and had then driven off to the next town. Some hours later, Johnson landed and was speaking in front of the courthouse. The temperature that day was 106 degrees, and candidate and crowd were sweltering as he talked, when suddenly Johnson glanced up at the window and saw courthouse clerks and county officials peering out, and noticed that the window was closed and that there was an air conditioning unit protruding from it. "Look up there," he shouted. "Look in the window. There's Coke up there. Folks, I'm out here talking to you man to man in the hot sun, and that's where Coke is, standing up there in that air-conditioned courthouse looking down at us." Coke, of course, wasn't one of the faces in the window. He wasn't even in Weatherford any longer, but the people in the crowd didn't know that. Recalls an observer, "He, Johnson, pointed up there, and sure enough there were people behind the window looking down. You couldn't see them clearly, and I'm sure everybody thought one of them was Coke, all nice and cool while they were sweating." Thereafter, the heat and the air conditioning, the blazing sun, and the fact that he, Lyndon Johnson, was out there in it with them, were staples of his speeches. "My opponent does his campaigning in the Ramada Club and the Petroleum Club, where it's air-conditioned," Johnson would say. "He does his campaigning at buffet lunches with millionaires who think they're the bosses of this state. Well, I'm out here in the hot sun campaigning with you, because I know who the bosses of this state really are. You. You. You who I meet in the squares and the fields. You who I meet out here in the hot sun. You're the real bosses of this state." The mimicking got laughs. This touched a deeper chord. "That's right, Lyndon," someone would shout. "You tell 'em, Lyndon." And suddenly other voices would be shouting, too. "Tell 'em, Lyndon. Tell 'em, Lyndon." "Yes, you're the bosses," he would shout to men and women who had to work every day, in fields or farmhouse kitchens, in fierce heat. "You're not sitting up in any air-conditioned rooms, and neither am I. I'm out here in the fields and the squares, and it's the people in the fields and the squares who are going to elect the next senator of this state. He's going to be elected by you." "You tell him, Lyndon," a voice would shout. Another voice would shout, "Amen." And all at once, many voices would be shouting, "Amen, Lyndon, amen, Lyndon, you tell him, Lyndon." He told them more. In one speech, he said, "I'm not going to sling any mud in this campaign." Then he said that Coke was 61 years old, actually he was 60, and was campaigning for a job that paid $15,000. "Old" was a word he drummed into his listeners. "He's an old man," he said, "a big-bellied, pipe-smoking old man." And it was the old men of the Senate who had kept the United States from being prepared for the war. "We don't need any more big-bellied old men in the Senate." Isolationist was another word he drummed into his listeners, until he started using a stronger word, appeaser. Stevenson, he said, is an umbrella man. He talks Chamberlain talk. He wants another Munich. You can put this in your pipe and smoke it. Texas is not going to send either an appeaser or an old man to the Senate because the immediate job is not of appeasement, but preparedness. Another word was stooge. The proud Stevenson would pick up newspapers to see headlines like, "Stevenson stooge of Austin lobbyists, Johnson charges." As governor, he said, Stevenson had been the tool of the big oil companies and the trusts and the interests. And now, he said, these same men who sit with Coke in air-conditioned hotel rooms want to put their stooge in the United States Senate. The attacks grew harsher and harsher. Coke's refusal to make specific campaign promises, Johnson said, was designed to deceive the voters. For too long, the voters have been deceived by candidates who spoke to you in glittering generalities, but who secretly engaged in double talk. By this man with the slick tongue. So powerful were Johnson's speeches now that even reporters and aides sometimes found themselves stirred by passages they had heard hundreds of times before. Talking about the need for preparedness from a flatbed truck in a little park in an East Texas county seat called Canton, he had gone through the routine about Colonel Stevens's smelly socks, and was telling his audience that never again must we send our boys through flak-filled skies unprotected. In the audience was Warren Woodward. He was ready to start the applause at the high points, but this wasn't necessary, so caught up was the crowd in what Lyndon Johnson was saying. Woodward himself was so moved that when Johnson said, "I've got this young man working in my campaign who flew 35 missions over Europe and his plane was hit 35 times, and I don't want him to ever have to go over there again unprepared. We have to give him the tools he needs." Woodward applauded and cheered along with the farmers and ranchers around him. And when Johnson unexpectedly added a new line to the routine, Woody cheered that too, without at first grasping its relationship to him. "I want that young man to come up here," Johnson shouted. And Woodward shouted, "Yes, send him up." Not understanding, he was to recall that Johnson was talking about me. "Come up here beside me," Johnson kept shouting. And Woodward kept shouting, "Yeah, go on up, go on up." Until Johnson finally caught his eye, and finally it dawned on me that I was that one that was supposed to go up, and that he'd been shouting and leading the applause for himself. But when Woodward clambered up on the truck, mortified over the fact that he'd been calling for his own appearance, he realized no one had noticed that he had been among the shouters, for the whole crowd had been as moved as he had been by the words of the tall, haggard, grimy, perspiration-soaked man on the truck. You could see the rapport building between himself and the crowd, Horace Busby says. Rural audiences, normally so reserved, would start out at a distance in a semicircle, he says. But as Johnson spoke, almost every time the semicircle would edge closer and closer to him. Lyndon Johnson knew how to make the most of such enthusiasm, how to play on it and intensify it. He wanted his audiences to become involved. He wanted their hands up in the air. And having been a schoolteacher, he knew how to get their hands up. He began in his speeches to ask questions. The first ones he asked of the kids who had been so enraptured by the helicopter. "How many of you are going to tell your folks to be sure to vote?" he would ask. And then, "How many of you are going to tell your folks to vote for Lyndon Johnson?" Wrote a reporter, the hands would fly up as if Superman himself had asked it. Then he directed questions at the parents. "I'm traveling to places to see folks where no other candidate has bothered to go," he would say. "Am I the first candidate who's been here? Raise your hands up if I'm the first candidate you've seen." The hands would go up, and he could build on his questions, too. When he was speaking in a town that he knew Stevenson and Petty had not visited, he would say, "I keep reading about how many counties the other candidates have visited, how many miles they've traveled. Has anyone here seen another candidate?" If no hands went up, he would say, "Come on, raise your hands if you've seen another candidate. Surely someone here has seen one of them." "No one? No one has ever seen another candidate. Well, you're seeing me. I'm here with you." Or if, when Johnson asked if anyone had seen another candidate, someone did raise his hand, Johnson would ask, "Where'd you see him?" And no matter what the reply, Johnson had a line ready. If, for example, the responder said he'd seen Stevenson in a hotel, Johnson would say, "What did I tell you? I'm out here in the hot sun with you people, and my opponent, my big-bellied, pipe-smoking opponent, spends his time campaigning in air-conditioned hotels." As good as he was while he was speaking, he was better after the speeches, for after the speech came the meeting and greeting. He never just stayed on the flatbed truck or the platform, or, if the speech was indoors, on the podium, Woodward recalls. He would finish a speech and then he would hurry to the back door so he could shake hands. He didn't want anyone to leave before he'd shaken their hand. During the first weeks of the campaign, until perhaps that terrible 4th of July weekend, he had rushed through the handshaking, in the description of Woodward and Busby, all but throwing people past. There was no throwing now. The things he had been saying in the speech had made these rural Texans feel he was one of them. They felt he was approachable, Woodward says. They didn't hesitate to come over to him. And in a surprisingly large number of towns, not only in his own 10th congressional district and in the 14th, for which he had worked for almost 4 years as a congressional secretary, but in other districts as well, through his NYA activities or his 1941 senatorial campaign, he knew personally one or more of the people crowding around him. And through the favorable list his staff had compiled for each town, he was able to put names to faces. And when he saw someone he knew, Lyndon Johnson's face would, in the words of one observer, just light up with pleasure. He would reach out for him and call the man's name. "Old Bob," he would say, "how you coming?" He would put his arm around Bob's shoulders. "How are you?" he would ask. "I'm awful glad to see you. Well, the last time I saw you was when you came up to Washington to see Dick Clayburgh. I hope you haven't been up again without coming by to say howdy to me." "You haven't," Well, I hope you'll come up again and we can chat for a while. At almost every stop, Woodward says, there was someone he had done something for. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.